February oral arguments, Justice Sykes will not be participating in this case. The first case is 98-3289, Magyar v. Wisconsin Healthcare Liability Insurance Plan. Attorney Culhane representing a neurological surgery. Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, my name is, again, Jim Culhane. I'm with the law firm of Davis & Kielthal in Milwaukee, and I represent the appellant Neurological Surgery of Milwaukee. It would be easier for me, and I think with the court, if I used the term NSM to refer to neurological surgery and PIC to refer to the Appley Insurance Company. By my count, there were six issues raised in the Court of Appeals, including latches. I believe, however, there are only two principal issues in this case, neither which was even addressed directly by the Court of Appeals, and that is whether there is a sanction for violation of Section 655.24 sub 4 by failing to give notice to the Commissioner of Insurance, and also what is the triggering date or the accrual date for the renewal policy under Section 631.36 sub 4. The Court of Appeals didn't address those two issues. Instead, they addressed issues like constructive notice and failure of conditions in the renewal policy, which were in existence prior to 1189. I don't believe those two issues are even relevant here, but even if they are, I think the decision with respect to those two issues was wrong. And the third issue that the Court of Appeals addressed, the insured elsewhere issue, although relevant, I believe was based on an inaccurate assumption of facts. With respect to Section 631.36 sub 4, it's my understanding, based on the brief, that PIC has the impression or the belief that the renewal policy upon a failure of an insurance company to give notice within 60 days under sub 4 automatically renews, and that automatic renewal lasts for as much as 1 year. In this particular case, since it was a 9-month policy, it would have lasted 9 months. Of course, that doesn't help NSM, because if it only lasts 9 months or even a year, the underlying malpractice act was committed after that date, and the claim was made several years after that date, until I think March of 1993. I agree with Pick in certain respects. I believe there is at the most a 1 year renewal period, or 9 months, whatever the expiring term is. My point is, however, that period doesn't begin to run, doesn't get triggered unless and until the insurance company mails or delivers a notice of non-renewal. Otherwise, if you don't have that rule, the insured could lose a right before it knows it even exists. And also, the language in the statute, 631.36, would be superfluous. The statute specifically says that the insured has a right to have the policy renewed. If you're going to buy PIC's argument, that language would be superfluous. Also, it's obvious that the renewal is not automatic. If you look at the exceptions section in 631.4b, which talks about even if there is a foul by the insurance company, there's no harm if the insured cures elsewhere, has accepted replacement coverage, etc. So there's an option here with respect to whether or not that renewal policy is renewed. In my opinion, the statute only makes sense when the renewal period, it only makes sense if the renewal policy is triggered when the notice is mailed or delivered. I don't believe that you actually have to have actual notice here if you're an insured. I mean, there could be situations where the insured is on an extended vacation, etc., and it's no requirement in the statute that the insured actually receive notice of this. I think there's a compromise implicit in the statute. The legislator doesn't want the insured to hide from the insurance company. That's why you only have to mail or deliver a copy of the notice. But on the other hand, unless you mail or deliver, that policy renews, and then it renews when you need it, in this case, in February or March of 1993. The only other point I want to make about 631.36 sub 4A is that Sossen, in the Sossen case, the Court of Appeals determined that that section was ambiguous for another reason, granted, but I agree that it is ambiguous. I don't think the drafters of the statute had in mind the situation in our case, where we have a situation where the insured never paid a premium, and therefore was never really put on notice that, hey, after a couple of years here, you know, I'm not paying a premium, something's wrong, I got to inquire. We have a situation where the insured never paid a premium. And although I want to talk later about equities here, about constructive knowledge, et cetera, I think the drafters of the statute were more thinking about what happens if the insurance company gives late notice versus no notice, which occurred in this case.
Counsel, I want to walk through 631.36.4a. Am I right that that's the essential statute that we're dealing with here? Are there others, but that's...
Right, right, Your Honor.
Okay. So, it says that a policyholder has a right to have the policy renewed for an additional period of time, either a year or 9 months, and let's say 9 months in this case, unless at least 60 days prior to the date of expiration provided in the policy, a notice of intent not to renew beyond the expiration date is mailed or delivered to the policyholder. So, under the terms of this statute, a policyholder has a right of renewal.
Correct.
For 9 months. In this instance.
9 months.
For 9 months. And it's your position that that right of renewal is not a single 9 month period, but a multiple period.
No, Your Honor, I believe that it's a single 9 month period, but that single 9 month period doesn't get triggered until the insurance company acts under the statute by sending out a notice of non-renewal, either mailing it or delivering it to the insured. I mean, and the effect of that in this particular case is the same. And we're talking about having a policy being in effect in 1993 when the insurance company's intent with respect to at least Dr. Friesen was to have it expire or terminate on January 1, 1989. So whether or not it turns over or whether or not there's an accrual, the effect is the same.
If I could follow up, Justice Bradley. What is the language in the statute that buttresses your interpretation that there has to be a first notice of non-renewal before the one-year rollover begins?
Well, Your Honor, the language in the statute is that which specifically says that the policy does not terminate unless and until a notice of non-renewal is mailed or delivered to the policyholder. And it says as if there is a violation of that by not providing it within 60 days of the date the policy would otherwise terminate, the insured, quote, has a right to have the policy renewed, unquote. That's the magic language, I believe, in the statute that says that the right doesn't exist until the insured has notice of it, i.e. either through mailing or delivering of the notice. Otherwise, in this case, as again, the right would expire before the insured even knew about it, and not only that, when that knowledge was kept from the insured by the insurance company. It wasn't a third party that took the notice from it.
Let's take your definition then, and your triggering event, is it your position? I assume that a notice has never been sent by the defense.
I believe in this case, to be consistent, I would have to say that that big policy is still in effect because they still haven't sent
That's
notice.
That's what I was going to say.
Okay. Now, in the situation, and also we don't have a duplicate insurance policy in effect.
Well, let's, though, take a step further in the statute and go to 4B, the exceptions. And it says, this subsection does not apply, and I assume that means the right of a policyholder to have the policy renewed. This subsection does not apply if the policyholder has insured elsewhere. Well, let me advance the argument that your opposing counsel does. The policyholder has now insured elsewhere. So to follow your argument, you're saying this thing hasn't triggered yet. Well, I'm saying if you're waiting this long for it to trigger, the intervening event is that the policyholder under sub B has acquired insurance elsewhere. And once that happens, then you don't need a triggering event anymore. How do you respond to that?
Your Honor, I agree that the purpose of this, of the exceptions in sub 4 is to take care of the no harm, no foul situations. Does it make sense to have duplicate coverage if you insure it elsewhere or accepted replacement coverage? That's the whole purpose of subsection 4. In this particular situation, I guess the best way I can explain it is to reverse the facts. Let's assume we have the Court of Appeals decision, and then we had the exact same facts that occurred here. So now we're in 1993, and there's a Court of Appeals decision that says what it says. NSM comes to me and it says, well, you know, we just found out we don't have insurance. I should say to them, well, don't get insurance. Don't get insured by Wisconsin Health Plan, even on an ongoing basis, even though if you don't do that, you're going to lose your license, because if you do that, you're not going to be able to be insured under the PIC policy.
Well, and that's absurd, isn't it? Don't you think that's absurd?
It is absurd.
Okay, so I think where I'm trying to go is to see if your triggering event is the correct time. In looking at sub B, this subsection does not apply if the policyholder has insured elsewhere. And then I ask, when? Insured elsewhere, when? After your triggering event occurs, which to your argument has never occurred yet. So keep in focus, when? When is the relevant time for sub B? And let me advance that maybe it is at the expiration of, using the language of 4A, the expiration date. So when you read 4A and 4B, that if the policyholder has acquired insurance elsewhere, what time? At the time of the expiration of the policy, then subsection A does not apply. What's wrong with that interpretation?
Right, I guess maybe I need some clarification. But you mean the expiration of the policy, you mean January 1, 1989? Or do you mean 9 months after that in October of 1989?
Either, actually, for this case. But let me use the former.
Okay. In this particular case, I believe the policy, the PIC policy, well, first of all, there was no insured elsewhere in this case, factually. I mean,
well, we have insured elsewhere now, right?
On an ongoing basis, we have, yes. The Wisconsin Healthcare Plan policy that was purchased, I believe, in February 1993 is an occurrence policy, which it has to be, and it's even stated for that.
Say this again, what you just said.
The Wisconsin Healthcare policy that was purchased in 1993 is an occurrence policy.
Not a claims-made policy?
No. In fact,
I thought it said in the briefs that it was a claims-made policy.
The PIC policy was a claims-made policy.
Okay.
Let me give you, I think the best way to answer your question is to talk about Dr. Friesen, for example. Dr. Friesen PIC violated Dr. Friesen's rights under the statute by providing him with an inappropriate notice of termination under 655.24 sub 3, because they failed to tell him that if he doesn't insure, he's going to lose his license. There was no harm, no foul to Dr. Friesen, because he accepted replacement coverage in part with PIC with the tail policy, and then he also accepted replacement coverage with the Wisconsin Healthcare Liability Plan on an ongoing basis. With the lack of notice to NSM, however, we were prevented from doing both of those things, assuming we had no knowledge of it, until 1993, when Wisconsin Commissioner of Insurance let us know. So if it's going to apply any time before the insurance company sends out a mailing saying that there's notice, The exact same thing could happen here, and I realize that it's rare because we didn't pay a premium. And in most situations, the insured is going to have some type of duty itself to inquire. I agree with that. But when does that occur? I believe that that's a difficult thing for me to answer because I don't have that factual situation. But in this situation, when you're not paying a premium and you have no way of knowing that your policy has expired, it doesn't make sense for it to expire before the notice is mailed or delivered.
I want to return to my question and ask it just from ask it point blank. With regard to sub B, what is the relevant time period? This subsection does not apply if the policyholder has insured elsewhere.
Right.
Has insured elsewhere when?
Okay. During the 60 days, I think that the point of the drafters of subsection B was to take care of the situation where during that 60-day period, before the underlying policy is terminated or otherwise expires, the insured has insured elsewhere. Therefore, even though there's a lack of notice, it didn't harm the insured because he's insured elsewhere, or has accepted replacement coverage, in this case with PIC, or has agreed during that 60 days to non-renewal. It's the purpose of the 60 days is to give the insured sufficient time to decide what to do when he receives that notice, or when he or she, of course, decides, they don't need insurance. It doesn't make sense to me unless it applies during that 60-day period. And also it doesn't make sense unless the insured elsewhere also reverts back to subsection 4, which talks about having that substitute policy be on the same be on the terms then being applied by the insurer to similar risks.
There were two doctors. NSM had two doctors, two major doctors in 1987, et cetera.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Dr. Frazen was one of them, and there's a Dr. Strasburg.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What happened to Dr. Strasburger's policy beginning in 1989?
I don't know. I believe he still remained with NSM. And I think Dr. Frazen was the only one at that time who left and still remained with NSM. He still left the coverage with PIC, but remained as a doctor with NSM. I believe Dr. Strasburger remained with PIC and with NSM. The reason Dr. Frazen was let go because of his claims history, which I don't think applied to Dr. Strasburger.
Well, now, the reason this was policy that you didn't charge premiums was if you covered Frazen and Dr. S, then you were already covered for NSM, in effect.
Right. If you covered Dr. Frazen and Dr. Strasburger, there were no premiums. I think it was a marketing tool used by PIC.
You didn't need coverage for NSM because if you had Frazen and Dr. S covered, you covered the whole entity, apparently.
Well, if there was a claim made, for example, against NSM on a situation where they were the principal and there was another agent involved in their employ, they would need insurance for that, sure. They didn't just have to have Dr. Frazen and Dr. Strasburger being sued for that policy to kick in.
Except that probably an agent would be covered by either Dr. S's or Dr. Frazen's policy.
Well, Dr. Frazen, the one thing I don't want to miss here is that if we had received notice from PIC in time, we would not be insured under the Magyar claim for the PIC policy. I mean, Dr. Frazen wasn't insured. Dr. Frazen received tail coverage, but then was insured by Wisconsin Healthcare Plan, and that plan is the one who covered the Magyar claim. And so we weren't able to do that because of lack of notice. We would have done the same thing Dr. Frazen did. The other thing I want to talk about was the Court of Appeals talked about, Your Honors, and that's constructive knowledge and conditions for continuing coverage. I don't believe either one of those issues is relevant here because of the statute. The statute doesn't talk about constructive knowledge. It talks about the requirement that the notice be mailed or delivered and also that you give grounds for that notice, otherwise the notice is ineffective. The only exceptions to that are, again, contained in subsection 4, which doesn't talk about constructive knowledge. There was talk in the Court of Appeals as to, after a while, you should have inquired, you should have done this, you should have done that, after getting bills, etc., or not getting bills from the insurance company that you were getting before. One of the problems I'm having with that is that there was no factual record, really, to develop any of that. But even if there was, I think the Court of Appeals said, all that did was confuse NSM after a while as to whether it had insurance. Well, if that's true, then I think the cases like Town Realty versus Zurich kicks in, where the insured is confused. Who's got the duty to make that confusion go away? The insurance company. The insurance company could have done that here by sending out a notice to the insured and to, you know, the Commissioner of Insurance. The other thing I also want to bring up is the tail policy. For the continuing coverage for NSM in this case, all the policy says is that all the doctors have to be insured with PIC under the same limits. Dr. Friesen obtained a tail policy, which did contain those two conditions. He was insured under the same limits, and he still was insured with PIC. I see my yellow light is on, so I guess I have a time. Do I still have 5 minutes?
Yes.
May I ask, in your brief, you started not with the failure to notify NSM, but the failure to notify the commissioner. Why did you pick that as your first
argument? Well, you're right. I also think that was a violation here. I think it's admitted there was a violation of 655, 24, I believe it is.
Is that a stronger
sub 4, which talks about notice to the commissioner of insurance. The issue here is that what should be the sanction for that? The statute doesn't contain a sanction, but my point is 344.34 doesn't contain a sanction either, but yet it doesn't make sense unless there's a sanction, and I believe the sanction should be that the policy continues, you know, until the commissioner is notified here, and the commissioner still hasn't been notified. Otherwise, there's the statutory scheme of making sure that health care providers continue to practice with a license is going to be frustrated.
So your position that as long as the commissioner has not been notified, it's just continued. So that could be 10 years, it could be 15, there could be changes where the policy owner has gotten insurance in other places, but the position is, seems unreasonable that would be go on forever, indefinitely.
Well, two responses to that, Your Honor. Number one, 344 sub 34 does take that into consideration when it says that the policy will continue until, quote unquote, in that situation, until the Secretary of Transportation is notified. In the Zeman case, for example, which was put down in the briefs by PIC, I think that case actually helps us because it talked about that situation where this could be an ongoing situation. The court in that case said, although we wouldn't want to, and it was dicta, we would have to do that. We would have to fine for the insured in that situation, and therefore they're alerting the legislator that there's a loophole here in the law. Let's do away with it. So I think the PIC case actually helps us. And besides that, in the PIC case, there was equities that weren't involved here. There were letters from the insurance company to the insured in that case, for example, that said that, you know, your policy is about to expire. Do you want to go with a higher premium? And also, there were premiums being paid in that case. So after 3 years, you would think that the insured would know, hey, I'm not paying any premiums. We didn't have that here.
What's the purpose of 631.36.4?
The purpose of it is found, I think, Your Honor, in sub 4, and sub, I'm sorry, sub sub C of section 1 says that, so their policies are not subject to arbitrary or unannounced termination. And I think subsection C, would be frustrated unless the triggering date is the date that the notice is mailed or delivered.
You're reading from
631.36 sub 1C.
1C, exemption by rule?
Right. It talks about policyholders needing protection against arbitrary or unannounced termination.
I mean, I look at this, you make reference to the financial responsibility statutes in 344-34. I look at this scheme, and particularly sub 4, because that's our focus, as the purpose is also one of financial responsibility, just like the 344 that you cite. And the purpose is that if there is a claim by an injured person, someone's going to have financial responsibility. And so we have all of these different tentacles being weaved together to come up with a fabric that says there will be financial responsibility, just like in 344. If that is the purpose, then I don't understand why under sub B of 4, that when you have the insured elsewhere, why that doesn't then say, okay, all bets are off. As long as the person has the same kind of insurance elsewhere, and as long as it, now you might get into a problem of, is it claims made, is it occurrence made, or is it, as you allege on page 28 of your brief, that there is no coverage by Wausau because the claim was a known risk at the time they got their insurance. So those are all issues, and they're not small issues. But if there truly is coverage during elsewhere, then why does any of this matter if the purpose is this fabric of financial responsibility?
Your Honor, I agree. If in fact NSM insured elsewhere, quote unquote, in this case, we wouldn't be here today.
And it covered. I mean, what you may have is because one is claims made, the other is occurrence. Unless you have an extension, which is what I thought you were going to argue, unless you have this policy extended,
right,
you're going to there's going to be a hiatus. Because even if they had gotten that policy immediately, it might not have covered this because the
That's
occurrence
right.
occurred on your watch.
Right. In February 1993, the only thing that was available to us was the Wisconsin Health Care Plan policy, which under the Wisconsin Administrative Code must be offered on an occurrence basis. That's why it didn't protect us in this case. Thank you.
And we have a division of the argument. Both counsel represent the Physicians Insurance Company, and both are from Quarles and Brady. You have 15 minutes. Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Davis has 15 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Thank you. Tell us how you're going to divide the argument.
Yes, Your Honor. We're going to, my initial argument is going to take issue with Mr. Culhane. I think there is a preliminary issue in this case, and that is whether either statute 631-36 or 655-24 applies at all. And secondly, I will address 655-24 in the event that that statute does apply. Mr. Davis will address 631-36. I say there is an initial issue here because under this policy of insurance, NSM, as of January 1st, 1989, was no longer eligible for coverage. And I think it's presumed in both 655-24 as well as 631-36 that if there is a renewal of the policy, and of course the statute says under the same terms and conditions, if there is a renewal, the insured is eligible for insurance. Now, Mr. Culhane very briefly mentioned the fact that he believes that NSM was indeed eligible because they received a tail endorsement, which is required under the insurance code. When a policy is canceled or non-renewed under 17.35, this is the insurance code, sub G, sub 1, the insurance company must offer a tail endorsement to the insured. Specifically, it says a guarantee that the insured can purchase an unlimited extended reporting endorsement upon cancellation or non-renewal of the policy. Therefore, we do have something called a tail endorsement here. However, under the policy of insurance at issue, and this is in the appendix, this is the eligibility section of the policy issued to NSM. In order to be eligible, it states that an insured must be insured by PIC and maintain the same limits of liability. Mr. Culhane is correct that for an act of malpractice occurring before January 1st, 1988, Dr. Strasburger and Dr. Friesen had the same limit of liability. Beginning in January 1989, Dr. Friesen had a tail endorsement, which protected him from he's insured against an action for malpractice that occurred prior to January 1st. He has no limit of liability, a zero, for any act of malpractice occurring during 1989. Dr. Strasburger, the other doctor, has a claims-made policy that affords him limits of $1 million aggregate, $400,000 per incident, for any act of malpractice occurring after January 1st, 1989. Therefore, Dr. Friesen and Dr. Strasburger do not have the same limits of liability. And as a result, NSM is not eligible for coverage after January 1st, 1989, under the terms of this policy.
Would you explain again to me? I just assumed that the tail insurance was a continuation of the underlying policy here. Now, you're saying the terms, conditions, and limits on the tail insurance of Dr. Friesen are different than the policy that he had prior to January 1, 1989.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. After January 1st, 1989, Dr. Friesen was insured for an act of malpractice committed by him prior to January 1st, 1989. He had no coverage from PIC at all, no limit of liability, after January 1st, 1989. If he committed an act of malpractice on January 2nd, 1989, he had no coverage, no limit of liability.
If a claim was made, he would have,
for an event before, that's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. But after January 1st, 1989, his partner, Dr. Strasburger, had a claims-made policy that protected him up to $1 million for an act of malpractice occurring after January 1st, 1989. So these two individuals did not have the same limits of liability. And that's the whole purpose for this policy, as Chief Justice Abramson stated. Obviously, it's afforded free of charge because PIC is insured, in effect, by the policy of insurance it's issued its doctors. They both have the same limits of liability. Now, all of a sudden, Dr. Friesen has no insurance, and all of it would fall on PIC. And having charged no premium, it just makes no sense at all.
PIC's not the tail policy, but the policy that was in effect in 1988, for instance, was both an occurrence and a claims made for the policy year?
No, it's a claims made policy, and there's a retroactive date, which really is when the policy is begun. It's the inception date. Here, I believe it was 1986. So each year when an insured renews a policy, it covers that insured for an act, an occurrence, if you will, dating back to the retroactive date, but only if the claim is made after the renewed policy, for example, January 1st, 1988.
How does this differ? I need help with this because it's not coming through on my radar. How does this differ with what I consider to be my normal view of claims made? That is, if I buy a claims-made policy, the act could have occurred 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, as long as there's no statute of limitation problems. And what I get coverage for is if in that year of the policy term a claim is made. That's what I thought was claims-made.
That's incorrect.
Okay.
When you take out a claims-made policy, you are not insured for events or an act, an occurrence, occurring before the date you take out that policy for the first time. It's called the inception date or the retroactive date. I mean, I suppose you could negotiate something with the insurance company, but typically, the insurance company is going to begin to insure you on a claims-made policy on the date you take out that policy. And what it means is for any occurrence, any act of malpractice in this case, occurring after the inception date, you are covered for a particular period of time, and that is the claim window, if you will. And so each year when you renew your policy, you're saying, if a claim is made against me for any act of malpractice occurring after the inception date of my policy, then I'm covered. But under your hypothetical, if I were to go to an insurer today and ask to take out a claims-made policy, a malpractice policy, they would not cover me for an act of legal malpractice that occurred last year.
And indeed, in the past, that's my definition of claims made is the definition, because it almost puts some insurance companies underwriting medical malpractice on a claims made basis, and that they were covering for years and years and years.
Yes. Well, certainly there's a retroactive feature to this. And that's why, frankly, the premium generally is fairly inexpensive for the first year, because you're not insuring against occurrences occurring before. And it's odd that you're going to have an occurrence and a claim made in policy year number one. But my position here is that we never address the issues of statutory interpretation, because under the definition here, NSM was not eligible for coverage. And it's not a non-renewal situation. If we renew the policy, NSM is still not eligible for coverage.
What section are you relying on again? I missed that.
Well, my position, Your Honor, is that neither 631.36 nor 655.24 come into play.
Right.
They only deal with renewal.
They don't come into play. Why?
Because NSM was not eligible for coverage.
And where do you find that? What's your statutory basis or your legal basis for saying that?
There is nothing in the statute, Your Honor, but it's only my position is that in order for a policy to be renewed, but let's assume it's renewed. Let's assume NSM is given a policy. That policy still says we're not insuring you unless you're eligible. And my position is under this insurance policy, they are not eligible because not all doctors carry the same limit of liability.
So you're relying upon the language in the policy.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, that's what
I wanted. Correct. Okay. Briefly, I'd also like to address 655.24.
Could I ask, you're relying on the language in the policy. Does that mean that no notice has to be given to the commissioner? No notice has to be given to the insured?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, because this is not a non-renewal of a policy. It's very similar to a policy that says in order for me to obtain insurance coverage, I have to be a resident of Milwaukee County. I take out a policy, I'm a resident of Milwaukee County. If during that policy term I move to Waukesha County, I am no longer covered because I'm no longer eligible under the terms of the policy. It's not a non-renewal situation anymore. The policy lapses. And this court has made that distinction. If we look at the supplemental appendix to the appellant's brief in this case, they cite the Peterson case, 65 with second 542. And in that case, this court distinguished between the lapsing of a policy and non-renewal. And they held that 631.36 does not apply to lapsing or the ending of a policy by its own terms. It only applies to a non-renewal situation.
I may be wrong, but didn't the Lane case that's referred to much later now, 100 with second, say lapses schmapses? In other words, what's translated means doesn't make any difference if you're talking about lapsing for non-renewal or cancellation. Wasn't that the Lane case that went into that discussion?
I don't believe it drew a distinction. It certainly did not overrule Peterson. What they were saying in Lane is that was a renewal situation. The insurer definitely intended that no insurance be applied because no premium had been paid. But it wasn't. That was a condition. With the payment of a premium, the insured would have had coverage. Here,
I thought the discussion, correct me because I've read a number of cases, but I thought the discussion of the insurance company in Lang, and the argument was, look, this isn't a non-renewal, this isn't a termination, this isn't a cancellation, this lapsed for non-payment of premium.
Well, and that was the improper use of the term. I'm not using the term lapse here. I'm simply stating that Peterson does distinguish between what was a lapse in that case and non-renewal. The fact that the insurance company in Lang argued that and it was not accepted does not apply to our case because there the insured was eligible if the insured would have paid a premium. Here, NSM was not eligible, regardless of a premium. It was paying no premium because it did not fall within the eligibility provisions of this insurance policy. It might be easier to look at this as if the policy renewed, would NSM have coverage? The answer is no, because NSM did not meet the policy criteria for coverage.
Okay, let me give you, this concerns me. Here we have two people that are the principals in this third entity, the corporation. But let's say you have a clinic with 30 shareholders as part of XYZ Clinic. And so you're telling me that if, and they sold as a marketing device, they sold this insurance to XYZ Clinic and says, as long as we get all your 30 docs paying the same premium, the same limits, the same coverage, we're going to insure you XYZ for not only what your doctors do, but also what your staff does, what your medical records person does, and any kind of negligence. You have your policy. So you have over here a shareholder, Dr. Smith, doesn't get along with the other group, doesn't, you know, is a real problem sort of person. And the insurance company notifies Dr. Smith, we're going to, just like here, we're going to get rid of you because of your history. So Dr. Smith doesn't tell XYZ because he's kind of on the outs with all of them. They don't pay him enough. And you're saying then, X, under the terms of this policy, XYZ can be canceled without any notification whatsoever because this ne'er-do-well over here in left field happened to be canceled and didn't tell anyone. That's what you're saying.
Well, first of all, that didn't apply here because the NSM was paying the premium for Dr. Friesen. There's no doubt in this record that NSM was aware that Dr. Friesen had been terminated from his individual policy.
Well, that gets the whole constructive act of actual notice and...
They were aware...
We can get into that. We can.
Yes,
but,
Your Honor.
But take just my hypothetical and forget that if indeed it...
I believe in an insurance policy, no matter who it's issued to. If it's issued to a corporation, and it has as a condition of insurance that all individuals must be insured and they all must be residents of a particular county, if one of the individuals who is insured moves out and does not give notice to his employer, that defeats the coverage. I mean, this is an agreed-upon contract of insurance.
But how does it defeat the statute? When I said before, the purpose of the statute is financial responsibility. So in my hypothetical, the statute and the notice requirements and all this elaborate stuff and the exceptions are all rendered meaningless because someone, as I said, is in left field and doesn't notify the entity. The insurance company doesn't notify the entity. You're saying the entity's insurance can be canceled without any notification. Because
the
terms of
insurance, it's like any other insurance policy. If you fall within an exclusion to the policy, that's negotiated.
Yeah,
an insured agrees that he's not going to be covered, and that's really what occurred here.
But counsel, that means you can write the policy to get around this statute. And I think that's Justice Bradley's point. And if it's not hers, it's mine. And the result is that what you can do is put down conditions and then say the policy lapsed. You don't have to give a non-renewal notice because you're saying that as a matter of insurance policy law, it's gone. There's nothing, it's lapsed, there's nothing to renew.
I don't think the insurance company can do that in this setting, Your Honor, because of 655. Very briefly, I want to alert the court to the fact that in 1975, when 655-24-2B was enacted, the legislature did provide that if notice was not given to the commissioner, the insurance policy coverage continued. So the legislature specifically adopted Chapter 655 with that proviso in 1975. In 1986, the court deleted notice to the commissioner as something that would trigger the continuation of coverage. At that time, they created sub 4, 655-24 sub 4. And that does require notice to the commissioner. And the commissioner has quite a bit of power under Chapter 601 to sanction insurance companies that play fast and loose, as Your Honor is suggesting. In fact, they can fine them. Certainly, the administrator of insurance can issue rules and regulations that preclude that conduct. And I would submit that an insurance company that does play fast and loose is going to be sanctioned very severely by the commissioner of insurance.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Davis.
Good morning. And as Mr. Armstrong indicated, I'll be arguing the issues with respect to 631.36 sub 4. And I'd like to begin by saying that until this morning, I really wasn't entirely clear what NSM's argument was with respect to the statute. It seemed to be a little bit inconsistent in the briefs. There was some suggestion that they were basically saying that we agree that we get an additional renewal but we can pick and choose when that additional renewal will basically accrue, depending on when we actually find out that our coverage has been canceled. There's another suggestion that they do get endless renewals throughout the period of that was at issue here. And this has to be an endless renewal case. And this morning, I'm glad to hear that at least we know where NSM stands on this issue. This has to be an endless renewal case because in order for them to prevail, you have to conclude that on January 1, 1989, when this policy expired, it renewed for 9 months beginning then. It renewed again beginning on September 30th, 1989. It renewed during 1990 when the negligence took place. And then it renewed again all the way up through 1993 when the claim was made, and even through December 1993 when the claim was reported. Because under this policy, all three of those events have to take place in order for there to be coverage. And as we discussed, Mr. Armstrong explained, that's generally the way the claims made policies work, and that's the way this policy works. So this has to be an endless renewal case. There has to be a conclusion for them to prevail that the insurer gets more than an additional renewal as the statute provides. Now, I think Mr. Colhain is, in essence, arguing that there should be two rules in this statute. One rule when there is no notice, and in that instance, the insurer gets these endless renewals on and on and on until some statutory notice is given, and that would mean that even today the policy is in effect. And another rule, this statute basically would apply when the notice is late or defective or in some other sense that the notice doesn't meet the requirements of the statute. And that simply, Your Honors, is absolutely contrary to the language of the plain language of this statute, which simply says if the agreed term is, the insurer has a right to renewal for an additional period of time equivalent to the expiring term, or if the agreed term is 1 year or less, for 1 year, unless that notice is given. It doesn't make any kind of distinction between no notice or defective notice or late notice. It basically says that's the sanction for not giving that required notice. And I think, you know, there's a couple of points I want to make that really bring home the point that it is only an additional renewal period. Number one, the outside term of this is 1 year. What if you have a 3-year policy? I think it would be their position that basically, instead of what the legislature is saying is that the extension expires after 1 year, that somehow it continues to renew, and you've changed the terms of the policy from a 3-year policy to a series of 1-year policies. That really does, that's sort of a non- The other point I think I want to make on this is that you look at 655.24, and while that really isn't directly applicable here, it states that any termination of the policy, cancellation or non-renewal, is not effective as the patient's claiming against those covered by the policy unless the insured has been notified as provided in sub 3 in section 631.36. Now that really is, I would submit, has the potential for being an endless renewal type of situation. It basically says...
Where were you reading from?
655.24.
Sub. What's sub?
2B.
2B. Yes. That really would have the potential, I think, to create a situation where patients continue to be covered. And that takes care of the financial responsibility concerns that have been raised by in particular Justice Bradley. But that really does contemplate, I think, a situation where unless that notice is given, that insurance continues in effect. Now, I will note, now, why would the legislature have that language with respect to patients if there was already an endless renewal situation under 631.36 sub 4?
Now, I'm having a difficult time reading. In short, what do you think sub 1 sub B says? 655.24.
Sub 2 sub B.
I think it basically says that patients have a right to have the coverage remain in effect as to them. They can bring a direct action against the insurer. The insured may have some kind of right of indemnification if the insured isn't able to pay on the judgment. But basically, patients have that right. And there's a distinction in 655 between, and we pointed this out in the brief, but between patients and others who have rights of recovery.
Give me an example. I still don't follow it.
Well, a patient is injured by malpractice. A person is basically injured by some negligent care and requires some kind of ongoing treatment for the rest of that patient's life. Needs money, you know, to do that. And the statute is basically saying that if the insured's policy has been canceled without giving this kind of notice in 631.36, that patient has a right against the insurer. Because that's what the statute says, as to patients claiming against insurers. And
I'm sorry, insured or insurers? I'm having some problem with
insurance. Insurance, the doctor.
The doctor.
Not
the insurance company, the doctor.
Patients claiming against the doctor would have a right to go back against the doctor's insurer if that doctor's insurer has not provided the notice required under 631.36.
Why doesn't the statute then mean you lose?
Several reasons.
Okay.
Number one, this statute wasn't enacted until 1990, and there's a retroactive date, I believe, of 1990, and it did not apply to this the arguably notice requirement that arose at the end of 1988. That's number one. Number two, we're not arguing here about a patient's right to recover. There's this patient, the actual plaintiff in this case has gotten full recovery. What we're essentially arguing about here is NSM's right to come back against PIC for the cost of defending its action. Number three, the plaintiff here wasn't even a patient. The plaintiff here was the estate of a patient in the family of a patient. And I think in that situation, you know, the statute is very clear in just making distinctions between patients and others who may have rights of recovery for negligence, including families, family members, and estates. So really there's three reasons. And I think, you know, right out of the box, this statute simply doesn't apply. And I think it's worth noting that this statute was amended in 1990 to add the language that says that patients have this right if the notice isn't given as provided in 631.36. So, in essence, I think this statute basically shows that the legislature saw a need to make it clear that the industry renewals might exist with respect to patients. But why would they do that if that endless renewal right already existed by virtue of 631.36 sub 4? Now, there's a couple other issues. If the court is prepared to conclude that somehow there is a right of endless renewals in 631.36 sub 4 for a failure to give notice under the statute, I think we have some other issues here. And that is, how long does that endless renewal go on? I mean, when is it exactly triggered? I would submit that where you have a situation where the insured, and this really is the constructive notice issue, where the insured receives declaration pages showing that it is not an insured anymore, which happened in, the NSM stopped receiving deck pages after 1/1/89. The bills that were sent to NSM no longer had NSM as one of the insureds. And one of NSM's officers and directors, Dr. Frazen, received notice of termination that he was terminated, and the policy provided that so long as that the NSM was covered, only so long as all of the doctors were covered with equal limits. I would submit that at that point, this so-called right of endless renewals, if it ever exists, would only go from the time that they received that constructive notice.
I have concerns about the constructive notice issue, because if there's one thing we want are some bright lines. Can't always have them, but we want bright lines. And constructive notice, I think very problematic. You know, I went in my prior hypothetical to 30 doctors in the clinic. here it's a tantalizing fact situation because you have two principals that make up the entity. But I just am very concerned about constructive notice.
I'm glad that the court is wants bright lines in this area, because I think the legislature really has drawn one with the notion that you get an additional renewal. But what I'm saying is
what?
You get one.
That's
one additional
it.
Renewal. And that's and there's time in that instance. Basically, I think the legislature is saying, we understand that if the insurer basically is not giving you that kind of notice, we can see how an insured for some period of time could be caught unawares and not able to get coverage. But, within the next renewal period or within a year, you basically are going to be able to know that you don't have that kind of coverage. And insureds are expected, I think, to at least have that degree of diligence with respect to their policy. I guess what I'm saying with respect to constructive notice, if the court is prepared to fashion some kind of endless renewal rule where there's no notice given, then I think that the only fair way to fashion it would be to say that when the insured actually should know from other circumstances that the policy is being terminated, that in that situation, that an additional renewal period that Mr. Culhane concedes eventually comes into play, should come into play at that point. And then I guess the final issue I want to say is they admit they had actual notice in January 1993. And once you have actual notice, the insured is then basically given has the opportunity to obtain other insurance. And that's the insured elsewhere issue. And I think that really is part of what this statute really is designed to address, and that's to give the insured that opportunity to obtain other coverage. Not necessarily the opportunity to obtain it at the same rates or anything else, but that opportunity is designed for notice, basically. And once the insured receives actual notice, which they admit they did in January 1993, then at the very least, that one additional renewal ceases. And once they obtain other insurance by the clear terms of the statute, they no longer they no longer have a right to that additional renewal period after that point.
How do you cut off the endless renewal with respect to the notice to the commissioner? A notice to the insured, you've got this sort of statutory language you can play with. But how do you cut off endless renewal on notice to the commissioner?
Are you talking about under 655.24? I don't think you do. I think that basically the insurer has to give that kind of notice to in order to cut that off. That's to give a notice that complies with 636 or 631.36(4), because basically there's an interest in protecting the patients claiming against the insurer doctor.
But then don't you lose?
No, it's not a renewal at that point. That statute doesn't apply to this situation because it was done basically in 1990, and it's not a renewal.
There was no requirement of notice to the commissioner before 1990, or what?
There was a. I don't think there was. I don't think there was a requirement of notice to the commissioner before 1990 that required that the notice comply with 631.36(4). As I understand it, basically, Mr. Armstrong, actually, you might be able to address that issue.
Because that's
really more of a 655 issue.
Your Honor, there was a requirement from 1975 until 1986 requiring notice to the commissioner. Absent such notice, the policy would continue, coverage would continue for patients claiming against an insured. In 1986, the legislature dropped the language saying that the policy would not terminate, and it did move into sub 4, which is the way the statute presently reads. It does require notice to the commissioner. As Mr. Culhane has stated, there is no sanction per se for violating sub 4. As the statute presently reads today, there are no, the statute does not say there are renewals for failure to notify the commissioner. Sub 4 simply says the insurer shall notify the commissioner. And a violation of that statute obviously could cause the commissioner to take action against an insurer. And I would submit that a patient who's injured by that failure to notify the commissioner would have a cause of action against the insurer. But the way the statute presently reads, there are no renewals. There was until 1986, but the legislature specifically deleted that requirement. So I think we can infer from that the legislature does not deem a failure to notify the commissioner to trigger renewals.
Now, are you both saying, or either one of you saying, 655.24 with the notice to the insurance commissioner deals with the patient, and 631.36.4 deals with the right of the policyholder?
That's correct, Your
Honor. So you're separating these two statutes out, the patient statute and the policyholder. You're saying the patient statute here doesn't apply because of one, changes in the statute, and two, you're not dealing with the patient.
Well, the sub 4 does apply, Your Honor, and there was a violation of sub 4. What we're simply saying is that the legislature has not provided for a continuation of coverage as a result of that. Otherwise, that's correct.
Thank you.
And I was addressing the effect on
631.26. You have about one moment to sum up, counsel.
Yeah.
The red light's on.
Okay.
You have a moment. Go ahead.
Well, I don't really have anything else to address unless the court has any questions on the point. So.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Davis. Mr. Cohane, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to whether or not NSM was eligible for coverage under the PIC policy after 1189, I think the answer to that is clearly stated in the statute as being irrelevant as whether or not that policy renewed and whether 631.36 applies. First of all, subsection 6 of 631.36 states that the notice must state with reasonable precision the facts on which the insurer's decision is based. No such notice is effective until it states the facts. Not only didn't they give notice, obviously, the notice didn't contain that, the fact that we were ineligible and that's why, you know, we were being terminated. So obviously that doesn't work. Number two, the Section B exceptions says that lack of notice is accepted only if, and I'm leaving out the words that don't count, if the policy is expressly designated as non-renewable. This policy was not expressly designated as non-renewable. What we're basically talking about here is a circular or catch-22 type of argument by PIC here. For example, what they're saying is we wanted to terminate NSM as a 1189 because not all of its physicians were insured after that date. We didn't give them notice under the statute, but they shouldn't be heard to complain because we want to throw them out because that condition we don't think still should no longer exist. That's like saying if you didn't pay a premium, you can't complain if we didn't give notice because if the policy is going to continue, you've got to pay a premium. Or like subsection 4, subsection 2, midterm cancellation, it talks about cancellation of policies when the attainment of an age specified. If you don't give notice, that policy continues even if that person or that condition of age is no longer exists. This is a non-entity, whether or not that condition or non-eligible applies. 631.36 obviously applies here to NSM. With respect to whether or not 631.36 sub 4 is an automatic renewal or an optional renewal, I think you look at two things. Number one, you look at sub B, which talks about the exceptions, clearly stating that the renewals are not automatic. And number two, you look at the phrase right to have the policy renewed, implicitly stating that it doesn't renew until the insured gets notice that you're attempting to do something here by either mailing or delivering him a copy of the letter. Finally,
just a minute. With regard to sub 4, 631.36 sub 4, why shouldn't I read sub 4 to mean that the policyholder has a right to have the policy renewed for an, meaning one, additional period? Unless notice is given.
It does mean that, Your Honor. I think that's how you should interpret it.
One and only one.
Right, one and only one, but the question is when does that one and only one start? When does that period start? I believe it's when you mail or deliver a copy of the notice.
So actual notice is meaningless?
I'm sorry?
Actual notice?
I think actual notice is irrelevant for purposes of the statute, and it's a policy decision. Otherwise, we'd be getting into all kinds of defenses and trials, et cetera, as to whether or not you had notice from other sources. As far as 655.24.2b and whether or not the non-notice to the Commissioner of Insurance is relevant, subsection 2b specifically doesn't refer to not giving notice to the Commissioner. It talks about giving notice to the Dr. Frazin in this case and giving notice to the insurer. 655.24 sub 4 stands on its own. The sanction under 2B doesn't apply here. It says it doesn't apply here. So the only sanction that would make sense under sub 4 would be having the policy renewed, which I think Pick just admitted to. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I would like to ask you. The policy clearly states your entity is not covered unless all physicians and surgeons who are members of your entity are covered by individual policies of insurance issued by us. And I think there's another reference to the same sort of thing. Is that just not... Can you just ignore that?
No, I'm not ignoring it, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that just like the policy saying that your policy does not continue if you don't pay a premium, or like it says your policy does not get renewed if you reach a certain age, the statute still requires you to give notice of that non-renewal based on that reason on sub 6. That's what it says. The reason being is that not everybody reads all the terms and conditions of their policies. I'm not suggesting that it's not an accurate statement to say that this policy wouldn't otherwise renew after 1/1/89. I'm just saying that you have to give a reason for it. And based on their non-notice to us, and because we weren't paying a premium, we didn't receive notice of this until the commissioner told us. So you don't ignore it. You just say, basically, who put us in this position in the first place? It was the insurance company, so the condition doesn't make any difference that would otherwise exist, because we go back in time and the policy that was in existence in 1/1/89 and earlier is the one that should be renewed when we receive notice from the mailing or delivery of the notice. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Colleen. Thank you, Mr. Davis. Thank you, Mr. Armstrong. That concludes our hearing on...